With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Fabio Vigi is with me today. Fabio is a professor of Italian and critical theory at Cardiff University in the UK, and he is the author of multiple books. His most recent, which was published about a year ago, is Unworkable: Delusions of an Imploding Civilization, published by SUNY Press. He also publishes long-form essays quite frequently at philosophicalsalon.com. Fabio, welcome back. How are you, my friend?
Hi, Jesse. It's all good here. End of a long week. Very interesting. A lot of things happening in the world. But yeah, all good. Thank you. Yourself?
I'm doing well, all things considered. End of a long week here, too, and a very interesting one, I'll agree. Yeah. So, speaking of delusions of an imploding civilization, we've seen the implosion really come home over the last 2 weeks, starting with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, and then that spreading to Silvergate, Signature, and then going abroad to Credit Suisse in particular, but many other banks in there on a global level have been affected, and I suspect many more are going to be affected in the days and weeks and months to come. And when I first heard that SVB was in trouble, my mind immediately went to bonds, which you and I discussed in some detail last time, even though I wasn't aware at that point what exactly was going on. I thought bonds, I had some intuitive feeling about it. And lo and behold, bonds, particularly treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, were at the heart of what happened to SVB and have been at the heart of what's been happening to other banks on a global level now. So it seems that the bubble you and I spoke about last time has finally burst. And we're talking about supposed assets here that are allegedly the most secure and stable you can purchase and hold, and they've imploded, to use that word again. And I think this really speaks to what you and I have talked about many times in terms of there being no real economy and thus no real value. And so even the most secure assets or supposedly secure assets prove to be extremely fickle, really backstopped by nothing, and thus prone to what we're seeing now. So that said, I'd like to get your reaction to what's been happening.
It's I think you're right in saying that it's really hit, this crisis really hit through the bond market, particularly these long-term treasuries that were supposed to be extremely safe, right? And the smaller banks or regional banks, like, you know, not small but certainly medium-sized banks like SVB were very exposed to these long-term treasuries, particularly. But of course, in the current environment, the price of these bonds falls as interest rates go up, which means that these bonds lose their value. And it also means that they can no longer be used as collateral for more borrowing, right? Or they don't really function in the same way, precisely because the prices is tanking. So they kind of increasingly become what they always already were, which means worthless paper. And because these banks were heavily exposed to these treasuries, which again they thought they were safe, they, you know, discovered the hard way that in fact they were not safe. So you know, this is one of the reasons, probably the main reason, why SVB collapsed, and then the contagion started, and it, you know, and obviously they're trying to tell us that the banking system is solid. That's what we hear every day, that we shouldn't worry, that the banking system is solid. But the reality of it is that it's in terrible turmoil. The turbulence is increasing, and therefore, you know, as you said, even the big banks seem to be in trouble. I mean, Credit Suisse is a major, you know, financial entity. It's one of the Fed's primary dealers, and it's been now bought by UBS, you know, which is another of the Fed's primary dealers. So this contagion is affecting now the whole banking and financial system, as you said, rightly say, starting from the debt bubble that has started to implode. There's a question, however, that comes to mind when looking at this kind of slow motion meltdown that we are witnessing now. And the question is, to what extent has this happened, you know, as an accident by itself? Or, you know, has it happened as a kind of controlled accident? You know, that's the mm-hmm. question that I've asked myself several times this week, because it really seems as if this is part of what we've also been discussed several times before, which is this controlled demolition of the economy, where the emphasis should be on the word controlled. Because what we're seeing is effectively a consolidation. Maybe, you know, you tell me what you think, but I think it's a kind of consolidation of economic power at the top of the, you know, the pyramid here, the financial pyramid. So the bigger banks, those banks that are too big to fail, right? The same banks that have received so much liquidity throughout COVID and even before COVID, starting in 2019, those same banks are now acquiring the smaller banks and their non-toxic assets as well. So they are effectively consolidating their power at the top. And we in Switzerland, with the UBS and Credit Suisse, I think we're seeing something similar. It's a really big bank. I think it's the top Swiss bank, basically acquiring Credit Suisse. I think the cost was 3.2 billion, which is really not much, considering, you know, the total value of Credit Suisse assets. So again, consolidating, it's not as if the whole system is in meltdown. There's a kind of, seems to me, at least, controlled demolition of that very financial system that, however, is meant to it's meant to strengthen the system somehow by centralizing power at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what's happening to the economy as a whole, right? When we talk about the destruction of the middle classes, when we talk about, you know, again, the concentration of power and wealth in the hands of a few, a few billionaires or whatever, you really are talking about the same kind of logic, that the system can reproduce itself only by, you know, in this sort of way, which of course demands more and more, you know, authoritarian ways of controlling it. Because if the people are getting poorer, for example, then of course you need the authoritarian structures to keep them under control. And the symptoms of this rebellion against this kind of implosion that requires more and more control is what we've seen in France at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, the rebellions that are going on, the insurrection that are going on there. So it's interesting because for me, at least, it's almost impossible to distinguish from you know, a real implosion and a somewhat manipulated implosion that mm-hmm. is still supposed to achieve a certain goal. And the goal is precisely this, I think, consolidation of power at the top. Again, it's still a delusion, right? It's still within that logic of delusion. The system can no longer reproduce itself simply through financial, you know, what I call the perpetual motion of the financial machine. You know, it's the idea that you can create perpetual motion simply by pumping trillions into the system, you know, credit, debt, whatever you want to call it. That's an illusion. That's a massive delusion. But at the same time, within that delusion, you get a form of agency whereby there's an attempt to control it precisely through this, you know, consolidation of power at the top. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very interesting to see it that way. It's real, but at the same time, it's controlled. And it's somewhat, I mean, the banking regulators, of course, knew that this was going to happen, right? With SVB.
Yes, they had to know.
They had to know that they've known it for a while. But they almost decided to sacrifice it, you know, and they've almost decided to precisely put into place this contagion, hoping that they could, of course, control it. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to control it the same way that they've tried to control previous ones. In other words, by pumping money into the system. We're already back to QE. You know, they are already doing backdoor QE, as it were, pumping billions of cash created on computer screens, so electronic cash, mouse clicked, into the system to keep it afloat. And that's interesting also because at the same time they're raising rates. They're continuing with this, again, illusion that by raising rates by 25 basis points or you know, half a point, you can actually stop inflation. You can do mm-hmm. something to inflation. They're selling to the public this other illusion that you know, that they're actually doing something against the erosion of purchasing power. So we are really within this very strange dimension where things happen, but it's almost as if the decision to make them happen has already happened before, you know, before them.
Yes.
I don't know if it's clear or not. But with SVB, it really struck me as a case of that manipulation, because as I said, surely they knew that it was going to collapse, that it was so exposed to those treasuries, and at the same time that it had very narrow deposits, so that as soon as people, you know, take money out, as soon as there's a bank run, they would immediately fold. Which is what happened. So, I think this is really an exercise in consolidating, in almost desperate, if you like, you know, from a certain angle, to consolidate power at the top once more, to consolidate the system at the top in order to avoid, you know, a crash, a market crash. You know, better to do this than experiencing a sudden market crash that would really cause havoc, you know, across the system. And I think this is really what is going on with this contagion. And obviously they think that they can control it. And that's, again, difficult to predict. You know, it can really go either way. But from their perspective, they know that they have a very strong weapon, and that's this money creation programs, you know, that they can use to save the big banks for sure. Or they can use to allow a big bank to acquire another big bank, you know, like mm-hmm. Credit Suisse. So we've got to be, again, careful when looking at this meltdown, because I think it's in many ways a kind of another exercise in controlled demolition.
Yes, I fully agree with that. And I think when you say slow motion, you're right about that. If you look at it in on a certain timeline, but if you take what's been happening over the last 2 weeks, it's an acceleration segment of that longer timeline. What we've seen over the last 2 weeks has been a huge acceleration of the implosion we've been witnessing for at least 3 years now, if not longer. And I think that there are plenty of evidence points to at least suggest that there's a hand pushing this acceleration. And one of those points is when I look at the Fred's M1 chart, it started going up after having gone down for quite some time. It started going up on Monday, the 30th of January. So at that point, it was at 19,394,000,000,000. Yeah. And on February 6th, a week later, it was up to 19,432,300,000,000. And that's the last information available. The next update comes out on the 28th next week. So already the money supply was starting to increase at the end of January, which was over a month before SVB went kaput. And in addition to that, you had people like Peter Thiel, for example, the vulture capitalist, who was telling people and entities to get their money out of SVB. You had JP Morgan recommending recommending the same, or basically telling people to do the same. And you had, and this is a story that's, it's been covered, but I'd like to see a lot more coverage, and I'll be doing more looking into this myself, but Israel was able to get $1 billion out of SVB in advance of its implosion. So it had some kind of foreknowledge, at least, of what was going down. And then to add to that, on the 9th, as SVB was imploding, Powell, who is the chair of the Federal Reserve, he was in front of the U.S. House Committee on Financial Services. And this is according to a piece by Ledger Insights. It's an outlet whose tagline is Blockchain for Business. And according to this article that was published on the 9th, during this semi-annual monetary policy report, Mr. Powell said that a wholesale central bank digital currency, CBDC, might bypass Congress and be issued without approval. The chair also noted that a CBDC is still years away. Nonetheless, he was in front of this congressional committee saying a wholesale CBDC is in the works. We all know this. So is a retail one. We know this too. And the wholesale one could be put on the game board, if you will, without congressional approval. And again, that in and of itself should raise red flags, but this is on March 9th as SVB is imploding. So you take all of those evidence points and
You joined the dots.
You joined the dots, and I would say they more than suggest that this was that we're talking about something controlled here, something pushed into reality, maybe as a preemptive move, but nonetheless pushed into reality. And it's important to remember these actors and these entities, they can't control everything, even though they have massive control. But all of that to say that I agree with you that this is not, in a sense, it is organic because it's
right.
The natural results of what's been done for years and decades now.
Yes.
But it's also preemptive. There's also an inorganic hand in it, if you will, because they know what's coming, and okay, let's speed that up and have a hand in shaping it rather than waiting for it to happen and then trying to figure out what to do.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the difficulty for most of us to really kind of understand how you can have a systemic implosion, which in a sense is just a kind of automatic type of implosion, almost like a deterministic implosion. There's nothing you can do about it. The system is folding for reasons that are internal to the system, and we've discussed them before, right? This has been coming for a long time. There's nothing new in this financialization of the system. It's been with us now for 40 years. And itself, the financialization of the system was the answer to a kind of impotence, a kind of exhaustion of the labor, the work-based society that already emerged at the end of the 70s with the third industrial revolution and microelectronics and digitization, and obviously been accelerated by the use of artificial intelligence. Now, that means that the labor-based society is crumbling, you know, is collapsing by itself, as it were, simply following that the law of value, right? The way in which capital valorizes itself. So there's a kind of impersonal dimension to this, anonymous, impersonal. The system is folding by itself because of its, you know, formulas, the way in which it works. But at the same time, there is agency. And that's the other thing. There is a hand, as you say. You know, there is agencies because because there are functionaries, there are bureaucrats that are pushing us towards more and more suffering here. And that cannot be denied either. So for me, what's really becoming interesting is to understand the connection between these two types of agency. One is an impersonal agency that is deeply systemic and that is very pervasive. And in philosophical term, you would say it's ontological. It's really got to do with us being subjects of capital, really. And you know, capital can only reproduce itself this way. You know, it would be delusional to think that we can go back to you know, the utopia of full employment and you know, the heydays of consumer capitalism and things like that, right? Whether we liked it or not, it we don't go back. We can't go back to that type of capitalism. On the other hand,
no more labor or surplus value.
Right. I mean, you don't get labor intensive industries anymore. It's impossible simply because technology forces labor out, you know, and I'm talking about value productive labor, not labor in general. You can always have bullshit jobs, right? So the system can create bullshit jobs for you, but that they are not necessarily value productive. So they don't produce wealth for the system as such. But the problem is that value productive labor has been replaced more and more by machines, and therefore that's how the system is, you know, self-destroying. And that's an internal law. It's an internal mechanism that, you know, nobody's controlling in a way. It's the system itself that is imploding that way. But on the other hand, as I was saying earlier, it would be wrong not to consider how this type of implosion is being controlled, right? It's really, I mean, there is agency. The word I want to use here is agency. There is there are people who have agency, and they are controlling this implosion in authoritarian terms. Mm-hmm. And they're making sure that you know, for example, CBDCs are the obvious end game here. Now, we all know that now, that they want to push us little by little towards a system based on central bank digital currencies. Then we can talk about how they're going to do it. We can talk about the different levels of CBDCs, because as you mentioned, you know, wholesale, retail, different ways in which, but nevertheless, it's still a kind of monetary slavery. And it's a form of authoritarian or totalitarian control, even that some people have thought about. You know, as simple as that. That you know, to do what? To make sure that this system can continue to reproduce itself in this sort of way. And yet, at the same time, there's no other way for the system to reproduce itself, right? So it's both there's both a mind behind it. And it's also a kind of automatic process. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is really fascinating, right? Because I talking to colleagues and friends, and you know, it's either one or the other. People are either saying, "Oh, we need to personalize guilt. We need to make sure that the people who are in charge are." And of course, it's part of the problem. And then there's other people who are saying, "No, this is just a systemic issue. Nobody's really responsible for this, because it's the system itself that is inevitably imploding. It's a kind of historical process." And for me, it's we need to be able to see that there's both responsibility and there's a systemic motion in place. You know, there's a contradiction that can no longer be concealed, and that it's becoming increasingly destructive, and it's really pushing the world to the verge of some disaster, some kind of form of barbarism, or some kind of totalitarian control. So. Yeah, I think the difficult thing is to do both at the same time, to see this as an impersonal collapse, something that has to do with the system, and to realize that there are some people or some groups at the wheel kind of driving us towards this outcome.
Right.
Is that clear enough? I mean, it's...
Yes, and I agree. And that's what I've been thinking about a lot too. And I think that a simple and perhaps simplistic way of looking at it is that the system is like a machine. It was created by man and, or by people, if I'm going to be politically correct.
Yeah.
And became too big to fully control, yet, and is reproducing itself because of that lack of control. Yeah. And that's all it knows to do. But at the same time, the creator of the system still has a hand in shaping mm-hmm. the inevitable reproduction of that machine or that system. And again, it's a simple and simplistic way of looking at it, but I think that's very much what we're dealing with here. And when we look at the international monetary and financial system, we're talking about a huge apparatus, the totality of which is almost impossible to conceive mentally. Maybe it is impossible to conceive mentally. And there are so many moving parts that play off of one another, that are interlinked and play off of one another, that can't be controlled by the stewards of the mm-hmm. machine, but they can control some parts and steer the machine, the system, in certain ways. And that's what we've been looking at, and that's what we're looking at here. Mm-hmm. Again, I would argue in perhaps the most accelerated form that we've ever seen.
Yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. This is, but yeah, I mean, this is an accelerated implosion, absolutely. But it's the same. It's the same disease, really, that we were already facing in 2008, and then there was resurfacing in 2019, just before the COVID. And now it's coming up straight away. You know, 3 years later, we are already back into it with the same debt-based or credit-based, the same thing, right? Debt and credit are just two sides of the same coin. Debt-based system that needs this constant injections, you know, waves after wave of cash, just, you know, created out of nowhere on computer screens by central banks, especially, but banks more generally, without this artificial, drug or whatever, they cannot survive. The system would implode straight away. So in a sense, what we call the real economy is already dead. There's no way that it can be resuscitated. The system is staying alive artificially, you know, what we get inevitably is a zombie system. A zombie system made of banks and mega banks that need this constant injection of credit in order to sustain their, you know, their speculations and, you know, derivatives, side bets of all sorts. So, you know, it's a crazy system when you think about it, right? It's a totally mad system based on pure speculation and the belief that really there is some value there.
Right.
The confidence in the system. That's why they keep repeating the word, you know, we have to have confidence in this system. As a matter of fact, it takes very little to lose that confidence too, and they know it. So, as you say, although there's people at the wheel driving these machines, at the same time, it remains extremely volatile, right? The whole thing remains extremely volatile because it really does take little to cause, in this case, a market crash. Yeah, and then we have all the geopolitical, you know, things as well that are happening around the world that are, collateral damage, as it were. They're part of this implosion, obviously, and they serve another function within it. But yeah, I mean, I think that basically it really is about understanding how the current system is a zombie system that is being kept artificially alive. We often still believe that we live in that old, you know, consumer capitalist society, really driven by consumer capitalism and by wealth creation in through labor. We are now no longer there. You know, the system has already morphed into a different kind of hyper-financialized, debt-based system, and an extremely volatile one that in order to survive needs a different set of values and different solutions, different type of solutions to be kept alive. So right. I think fundamentally it's really important that people acquire some kind of awareness that this is going on. Again, it's a matter of developing both a critique of capital as this blind, impersonal, and automatic dynamic, which in many ways is in us more than we dare to acknowledge, right? We are all part of this. But that alone is not enough. I think that needs to be coupled with some kind of organized resistance and opposition to those who are really managing this sort of violent course of what I call crisis capitalism or emergency capitalism. You know, I think doing one without the other kind of means getting it wrong. if we personalize guilt without including a deeper critique of the social formation, so we end up reproducing the current death spiral in many ways, right? So if we only personalize guilt, we don't change anything. We remain within the same situation, so it gets worse. But if we only critique the social formation, you know, as an impersonal machine, we also risk, you know, acting as the proverbial beautiful soul who fundamentally makes sure, perhaps unwittingly, that nothing changes.
Right.
So I think the difficult task is to do both at the same time. You know, yes. The systemic yes. critique, but at the same time, the critique of what's going on really on the surface of this system, you know, the steering of the system in a certain direction. It's important to do both. And I think it's important to understand that we need to do both. Doing one will not be enough, doing only one of those two things.
Right. And when you say that we're all implicated in it, you're not suggesting, I know you're not suggesting that people like you, people like myself are supportive of this system. I don't consider myself a capitalist. And it's what you're saying is that the totality of the system, again, the totality is so vast that we're encompassed in it, but we are still trying in our own ways and in our collective ways to resist that and to find a way out of it. And it's a system that is not only eating itself, but eating those whom it encompasses as well. And like you said, we're seeing this in France, and we're seeing this in terms of where there are pockets left in the world of actual labor and surplus value. So if you take Congo, for example, and the cobalt mines there that are actually producing real value, but what does that entail? That entails slave labor and increasing authoritarianism and exploitation of people en masse and in the worst, some of the worst imaginable ways. Or you can think of a Foxconn factory prison in China, right? Yes. So the centers, the increasingly diminishing centers of where actual value is produced are becoming more and more exploitative. Yes. They've always been exploitative, but exploitative in more and more inhumane ways, I would say.
Yes, absolutely. The competition also, right, for jobs is increasing tremendously. So people end up accepting terrible working conditions more and more just to get a job. But yes, it's the exploitation is increasing precisely because more value still needs to be created, right? I mean, it's not as if we live in a world that it's a hybrid world. Maybe that's the right word. Where it's fundamentally financially driven, but of course it's still based on commodity production. It's still based on extraction of value from labor. It's just that it's not the basis anymore. It's almost an appendage to the system. You know, real value production or pseudo value production takes place in the financial sector, where you have the self reproduction of the economic sign of money, basically, right? That bypasses labor, where it's simply, you know, you put money to work rather than people to work. That's how the financial sector works, and how any bank employee would tell you, you know, the moment you walk into a bank, they would tell you, okay, let's see how you can put your money to work, which is a fantastic phrase, but it kind of, you know, it tells you exactly how it is. It's the money that does the work in this, you know, magical world of finance, not the people. So the moment you bypass, the labor, and you're exiting effectively a labor-intensive global economy, and you produce your value in the financial sector, most of it at least, then you are really dealing with a different set of issues. And that now are becoming, you know, are kind of coming up to the surface in terms of the volatility of the system and the fact that the debt bubble might be on the verge of popping, as it were, as a consequence of the fact that it's been stretched and stretched and stretched for a long time. But as you say, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider labor exploitation. It still goes on, you know. In a sense, we are going back in time to, 19th century industrial societies, where people were truly exploited, you know, much more than they were in recent decades in terms of their labor. So it's in that sense, we're faced by a hybrid system that wants to remain capitalist and therefore wants to continue to extract wealth from people's labor. But at the same time, it knows that it's creating wealth fundamentally in the financial sector, which is not real wealth in capitalist terms, right? It's again speculative and pseudo value.
Right. So I think futures is the perfect example of that.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can't get any more speculative and immaterial than that in terms of something that's just not tangible in any conceivable way.
That's right. Derivatives in general and futures as, you know, part of this derivative universe here, you know, be talking about a quadrillion or more of value, you know, that exists in derivatives markets, which however it's purely, you know, it only depends on our belief that there is value there. It doesn't have any material basis. It's pure speculation. And it's based on the idea that this value at some point in the future will become real, you know, will catch up with its real basis in value production, which is again a delusion in today's capitalism, because today we've got to the point where really we are talking about two different entities. You know, the financial markets and the real economy are two contradictory even entities to an extent. If you want to save the markets, you've got to destroy the real economy, or you've got to, you know, control the demolition of the real economy. Otherwise, what you get is more and more inflation or a violent deflationary shock through a market crash. So in one way or another, the currency, the value of your currency is going to be debased. You know, this is what capitalism is telling us today, although it doesn't want to tell us that, you know, but basically if you look at it, because of its the composition of value is mostly created in this artificial way without, you know, bypassing the labor mediation in the financial sector, this inevitably turns into the debasement of currencies that are going to lose more and more their value one way or another. And I think they know it. They know it, and that's why they've thought long and hard about CBDCs, because that's the solution they have in mind to this big problem of currency devaluation. Now, whether they're going to do it you know, in a very centralized way with a monobank, as it were, controlling everything, a central bank controlling everything and destroying all the banking sector as well as the real economy, or whether they do it through a more gradual way, so giving even the banking sector the capacity to produce, to create and use digital currencies, that remains to be seen. But in itself, the idea of CBDCs is, you know, intrinsically dystopian, and you know, it really points to the creation of a system based on one form or other of monetary slavery. So the contradiction is that you're still within a capitalist system where you're supposed to think of free market capitalism, etc., and the labor market and so on and so forth. But at the same time, this system is already morphing towards a centralized, almost neo-feudal system. At the same time, you know, fully digitized control system. And it could well be that for a while we will be in this sort of there will be an overlapping of systems, as it was the case when the feudal system collapsed and the you know, the capitalist system was created. For a while, the two systems, I think, you know, coexisted. So, you know, in whatever the case, it's going to be, you know, verging on dystopian. If we don't come up with a difference, you know, with a real alternative.
Right. So let's talk about CBDC if we can.
Yeah.
Because what you talked about earlier, so you talked about mid-level banks like SVB imploding. And in the wake of that, we've seen depositors running to the huge commercial banks like Bank of America, like JP Morgan, and storing their deposits there.
Yeah.
But these banks have even more exposure to treasury and securities volatility than SVB did. So, and then we had the Fed raise the interest rate by 25 basis points on Wednesday. And so that's further devaluing the treasuries and the securities. And given that and the heightened exposure that these massive commercial banks have, it could be that that's pushing toward a collapse eventually of those commercial banks. But
yes,
there will be an overlap as those banks collapse and there's a move into CBDC, and CBDC will be put forth as, look, this is the safe way and convenient way to store your money.
Yes.
It's immune from volatility in terms of liquidity, et cetera. And maybe it'll even start with the commercial banks offering that before they're merged with central banks.
I think that's the most likely scenario. And of course, digital currencies will be presented as some kind of savior, you know, when people have nothing, that when they lose their jobs and they you know, they don't know how to pay the mortgage or whatever, they will turn to digital currency, regardless of the fact that, of course, they are controlled, so that everything they do from that moment on is under the control of some external agency, you know, a bank fundamentally. So I think the idea is to create this kind of this environment where people will naturally accept CBDCs, right? As a consequence of a crisis, a result of a crisis. I think that's what they're pushing the system towards, where the CBDCs, they won't have to enforce them, but people, at least some people gradually, you know, little by little, will not only accept them, but even demand them almost, you know, as some sort of safety net against their immiseration. So I think whether it will happen through a violent market crash or more a kind of controlled demolition of the banking system, starting from the small and medium banks, you know, like SVB, this will remain to be seen. There's a number of things that cannot be controlled, as you said earlier about this, that are difficult to control even for those who are sitting at the wheel of the machine. But at the same time, I think that's the direction. It's pretty obvious that that's the direction. CBDCs now have been experimented and, you know, by more than 100 banks, central banks in the world, and it's clear that we're going towards digital currencies as a consequence of the fact that physical currencies or real currencies are really losing their they're being debased very quickly. And again, they do raise rates, but I think they're preparing to pause and probably even to reverse to cheaper money at some point. You know, I think that will happen, and it could well be that that collapse of small banks are, you know, the reasons why, you know, they will use them as the reason why they're doing it. But for the time being, they're slowing down with rate hikes, whilst at the same time already doing backdoor quantitative easing. They've already committed to unlimited liquidity injections, right? So yes. I really see a repeat of 2019 here, 2018, 2019, when they started, when first they tightened the money supply, and then all of a sudden that caused the repo market crash. You remember in September 2019, and immediately mm-hmm. they had to inject billions and billions every day into the system to plug those holes that were opening up in the system. So I think we are in a similar kind of scenario. I just wonder whether, you know, they've thought of different ways of controlling this implosion. But the other possibility is
in terms of imposing on the populace,
yeah.
some sort of authoritarian regime like the yes, COVID-19 and also, operation.
Right. Something like that again. There could well be another global emergency, maybe related to the war, maybe, you know, some kind of nuclear threat or whatever, you know, which will force people into less and less consumption, and therefore it will somehow control, you know, the debasement of currencies. Again, it's a matter of controlling it. I think this is really what is crucial, the fact that they think they can control it. I don't think they believe they can avoid it, you know. They know that this is coming. But biding time, controlling it, and then slowly perhaps introducing the new money system, which is clearly based on digital currencies, controlled from the top.
Right.
I think that's where we're going, and I wouldn't be surprised if we were exposed to other shocks, you know, soon, like COVID or something similar that would help them to introduce this new monetary system they have in mind.
Avian flu.
I think for the time being they're going with saving, of course, the super banks, too big to fail. They won't let them fail. But at the same time, they are, once again, making sure that those very big banks are controlling the assets of all the insolvent smaller banks. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's more than 200 middle of the range or regional banks in the U.S. that are practically in the same condition as SVB now. Mm-hmm. So there is contagion. And these banks, they might well be absorbed by bigger banks. You know, if you think about, and you know, when you think about Credit Suisse and UBS, you know, this is exactly the logic. It's like buying these banks who are in crisis for pennies on the dollar. You know, they really on the cheap. And acquiring also their good assets, the assets that are not necessarily toxic. So that, to me, really, you know, suggests consolidation of power at the top, and that's the strategy. Whilst at the same time trying to do something to avoid a sudden increase in inflation that would create panic and would create even more uncontrollable chaos.
Right. Well, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal's front page right now online, and Deutsche Bank seems to be in trouble. The last update I got was that its stock is down 10%.
Yeah.
Its shares are down 10%. So people are selling off Deutsche Bank, whether that's transitory, as they like to say, or not, remains to be seen. But the contagion, as they put it, is spreading.
Yeah.
And we're about up to time, but I just want to point out too that there's been an attack on cryptocurrency, especially decentralized cryptocurrency, coming from a lot of corners, but particularly the Bank for International Settlements and the Financial Stability Board. And they're really trying to put the kibosh on decentralized cryptocurrency and and ramping up this idea that they pose an instability risk to the international monetary and financial system, and that the solution to that is central bank digital currency. So just to point that out, and perhaps that's something we can talk about next time, because I see that also accelerating and not something that's going to go away anytime soon. But for now, Fabio, thank you very much for joining me today. And
thank you, Jesse.
Sharing your insights. I always appreciate them. I always learn something. And I look forward to talking sooner rather than later again.
Brilliant. Speak soon then.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And that is it for me today. I will be back at the same time on Monday. Stay tuned for Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio.